This session has a rather odd title, Do Women Belong in Institutions? And we purposely entitled it that, thinking that it might engender some curiosity as to what it was about. It is not really about whether women should be institutionalized. Although, if some of you came for that reason, you may want to raise some questions or some points in support of that you think that they should. But that's not really what we're going to be talking about. I would like to introduce both myself and my colleague, Val, who will be beginning what we're going to do. And we would hope that there will be plenty of time for discussion. So we won't spend a lot of time talking ourselves, but we'll really leave it so that you can ask some questions and so that we can have some discussion. Val Ziegler-Morris is presently on the faculty at Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee. Her field of work is historical theology, with a particular emphasis in American church history. And she and I were colleagues together at Yale Divinity School. And so this week is for us a reunion, along with Barbara Rossing, who is the associate pastor of the Village here. The three of us were in seminary together. And Val is going to say some things to set a bit of a historical perspective on the whole issue of women, particularly in the institutions that relate to religion. It may be the church, it may be some other institutions, but that's where we're going to begin to say that where we are now is not the only place in history, but it does have some background in the rest of a longer history. My name is Barbara Lundblad. I am presently a parish pastor in New York City, and I'm going to say a few things about the Lutheran Church as a case study right now in this time of history, and talk a bit about what I think has happened since our constituting convention in Columbus, Ohio, earlier this year in May, and where we really are now that most of the bishops have been elected, that all the national staff people have been selected, at least the executives, and see where we are, whether or not it looks like women do belong in this institution called the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. So that's kind of where we're going, and hope that we'll have plenty of time for your questions. So Val, you can get us started.
Well, what I wanted to talk about was two things mainly, coming out of the 19th century. I think they're a little bit paradoxical, but when Barb and I were at Yale, sometimes we would study with Sidney Ahlstrom, who, as you know, was a great Lutheran and a great American church historian. He used to say every time he tried to explain why things were the way they were, he was always having to back up because something before had caused something else. And he said he'd inevitably end up with Moses on the mountain because that's really where everything started. So I'm going back to the 19th century to try to explain why we are where we are in the 20th century. And the two things that I want to focus on, I think, are sort of paradoxical. The first one is the development. And it really happens in America in the 19th century of the idea that men work outside the home at things different from what women do. It's a man's world, but a woman's sphere in the home, and that those two things are really different. That happens in the 19th century. Also, though, in the 19th century, we get the first ordination of women, and a real sense that women can be called to preach and to do the work of the gospel in a public way. So I think those things are sort of paradoxical, and that's sort of what I want to talk about. If we were sitting around here in 1800, I guess there wasn't a Holden Village then, but if we were, one of the things that would have been true was that there wouldn't have been factories much, And most work that went on in the home. Families that lived together, they weren't so much nuclear families as they were intergenerational. And the work that got done, everybody pitched in and did. Now, if you grew up on a farm like Barb did or like I did, you know that things were probably still pretty much that way on the farm, too. Everybody helped with the work that needed to be done. With the development, though, of the factory system and industrialization, what happened for the first time was that people who could afford it moved out into suburbs. They didn't want to be where the work was being done, or they didn't want to live there. And now, for the first time, the work that got income for the family was special, technical, and it was stuff that men did. Men left the wife and kids in the suburbs, went into town to work at the factories, and then came home. Now, the man's world was a tough world. The man had to win the bread. The man had to compete in the marketplace. Or at least that's what people thought. Now, what did women do then? Well, women occupied what they called woman's sphere. It was the woman's job to civilize, to Christianize, to bring moral virtues to the man. Because the man was really busy making money and saving the household. And he just lived in a different world. So it was the woman's job to civilize her man when he came home. It's real interesting if you ever get a chance to read some publications from the 19th century. Even when women write for themselves what they ought to do, everybody talks about how important it is to raise the children and to teach them the Christian influences. Because once the children get into the world that's wicked and cruel, where those kind of influences aren't real, then it's too late. The only way to civilize them, to Christianize them, is to catch them early. And that is all private. That's what goes on at home, and that's private. What goes on in the public world is rough and tough, and that's what men do. You might have heard of a guy named Alexandre de Tocqueville, who was a Frenchman who toured this country in the 1830s and then wrote reflections about it. In 1831, he wrote that in no country has such constant care been taken as in America to trace two distinct lines of action for the two sexes. So it's real clear, it's a man's world out in public, and woman's sphere is in the home, and it's private, and it's moral influence that you can bring to bear on children and on your husband, because they all need it, because they'll be going out into that world. All right, so that's one strand that comes to us from the 19th century. I'm sure all of us have heard that kind of talk or been subjected to that kind of understanding that, you know, that's what women do, this is what men do. Another thing that was really important in the 19th century, though, was religion. Sounds sort of funny, but the 19th century was a great age for Christianity. And at that time, people were certain that religion was something to do. They said, if you really have been justified by grace through faith, that is going to free you with so much gratitude that invariably you will live a life that tries to return thanks for God for the gift of salvation that you've been given. And in the 19th century, people were pretty sure they knew how you would try to live in thanks for God. What they thought you would do was try to reform society, to make it Christian. They also thought that you would really concentrate on your own personal holiness to develop not just a sanctified inner life. That's really important. Also important is to have a sanctified outer life, to live the way a person ought to live in the kingdom. But you start living it right now. One of the things that happened in the 1820s, a guy named Charles Finney was a really famous evangelist. He introduced a lot of new things, new methods, and when he preached and held services. And one of the things he did was he let women pray during revivals. And there was an enormous uproar over that, and Finney got into a lot of trouble with the other clergy. But Finney said, personal holiness is an obligation of every Christian, and it's an obligation for women too. So if men are going to pray during these revivals, then women must be given the chance to pray as well. That was really revolutionary. Also, women began speaking to promiscuous assemblies. Does anybody know what a promiscuous assembly is?
It's considered normal now.
Yeah. Well, this, for example, is a promiscuous assembly. Does anybody know why? Why is this promiscuous?
Both sexes.
Yes, both sexes are present. That did not occur. Women did not speak in promiscuous assemblies prior to that. But in 1837, the Grimke sisters, who were Quakers from South Carolina, made a tour through the Northeast, and they were speaking against slavery. And at first they were speaking only to women's groups, but they were so good that some men started sneaking in and listening to their anti-slavery talks. And then the Grimke sisters made a really radical decision. They decided that they would speak openly to promiscuous assemblies. And they did. And it was so awful that the Congregational Clergy of Connecticut issued a pastoral letter condemning them for speaking in promiscuous assemblies. Now, has anybody here ever heard of the Palmer sisters, Phoebe and Sarah Palmer? Well, they were really, they're famous in the 19th century because they started this meeting. Every Tuesday night, they gathered women together in their home, and they called it the Tuesday Night Meeting for Holiness. And at that meeting, basically they prayed, and people gave their testimonies. They talked about what it would mean, you know, really to live a holy life, really to act on your religion. One night, the husband of one of those women, a guy named Thomas Upham, who was a congregational minister and a professor at Bowdoin College. Bowdoin's where Joan Benoit went, so I always remember that. He came to one of the Tuesday night meetings for holiness. And after a while after that, men started coming regularly. And all of a sudden, Sarah and Phoebe Palmer were leading prayer and preaching sessions for men and women. Now, how could they do that? Well, they did it because holiness was a personal responsibility for everybody. Each individual should develop his or her own holiness and should act upon it. And that's what they were doing, and suddenly men were responding to that. And finally, in 1853, a woman named Antoinette Brown was the first woman officially ordained as a clergy person in the United States. She was ordained as a congregational minister. She had studied at Oberlin College with Finney and had gone through the theology course, the whole bit. But what Luther Lee said when he preached her ordination sermon was, you know, we're not here to make a minister, because that's not a human right to say that you are or you are not called by God to preach. Only God can call, and only God can ordain. And what we're here to do is recognize that you, Antoinette Brown, truly have been called. You've been given the gift. Now, after that, a number of denominations began ordaining women. Really wasn't so much mainstream denominations as it was Pentecostal groups that were beginning to form and holiness groups. Salvation Army, Wesleyan Methodist, Assemblies of God, later on Church of the Nazarene. And in actuality, there really were never that many women who were ordained. But as anybody could have told you, there were many women who, as they said it, carried the news. What they meant by that was, even if you weren't ordained, if you truly felt that you'd been called, and it truly was your responsibility to be holy and to live out your religion, then you would go around preaching the gospel anyway. And Sarah Palmer, for example, was never ordained, but she numbered among her converts 25,000. Or another woman who was licensed but not ordained by the Methodist, named Maggie Newton Van Cott, numbered 75,000 converts, men and women, among those who came to hear her preach, listened to her interpret scripture, prayed with her, and became Christians upon their own confession through the ministry that she had been able to bring to them. So again, I think what we see emerging from the 19th century is sort of paradoxical, isn't it? First, we got this idea that women belong at home, and that public stuff, like talking in promiscuous assemblies, is for men. On the other hand, you've got this idea, yeah, but the spirit of holiness works in every individual. And if God calls you, you really need to respond to that call. And that call can empower both men and women. But again, what we really see is the women are often working through uninstitutional methods. There are some being officially ordained, but most of them who have, you know, tens of thousands of converts are really sort of working on their own, recognizing their own call and having the strength to work with that even though they don't have official recognition from some ordaining body. So that's the story, I think, of the 19th century, sort of a maybe a contradictory story, and still a story of women not in institutions. I think really the voice of the 19th century tells us that no, women do not belong in institutions, maybe as inmates, but not as managers, something like that.
Oh, thanks, Val. Those of you who came in a little late, I hope you're getting the drift of where we're going, to set a kind of historical perspective and then move into this time in the history of the Lutheran Church. And I know that everybody at Holden is not Lutheran, and I don't assume that all of the Lutherans are part of the new, what we've been calling the new church, the ELCA. Just for curiosity, how many people are ELCA here? Are there a goodly number. That's probably helpful, and maybe I always have to have something in my hands, like my grandmother, who we noticed my grandmother on pictures, she always has her purse. And we finally asked her one time why she always had to have a purse. I mean, we didn't know if she was a small town. We didn't think she was afraid of theft there, but she just didn't know what to do with her hands, so she always carried her purse whenever we had family pictures. But if we can remember, Val was talking about, in a sense, the private and the public split, whether or not that, we could have a long discussion about whether or not that is still a real division in contemporary society in terms of women and men. But I would like us to look a bit at where we are in the ELCA and whether or not there is really a place for women in that institution. Val said that it looked like in the 19th century that that the women who were very powerful as preachers, as prayers, and speaking to promiscuous assemblies really did not do it with imprimatur of an institution, that it was something that they did it outside of that framework. And I think that's a question that we need to ask about whether or not women are allowed to have power within the institution that we call the Lutheran Church. If we look at some other kinds of divisions, and I'm going to just make up some headings, and over here to put voluntary, and these are my categories only, and they and to put over here paid. If you look at what has happened since Columbus and
1492.
No, not since Columbus, not 1492. Since Columbus, Ohio, and the Constitution. We won't look at quite that much. But I think there was a sense, those of you who were at that convention or who have read about it, was that there was a sense at that convention that, first of all, there were some people there at the convention who were rather bored, you know, that we couldn't really make decisions because everything had really been decided. So the only thing that could happen there was elections. But in terms of elections and in terms of a kind of spirit that was in at that constituting convention, there was a sense that this was a new day for the church. And there was a pretty strong feeling that by the end of summertime there would be some synods who had elected women as bishops, and that there would be some executive directors of our church who would be women, that women would have in the institution a very significant kind of role. Now we have, we're now long enough away from the Constituting Convention to look and see what has really happened. In terms of people who are paid, we have here 65 male bishops. We have, I don't know the exact numbers, but almost all except three executives.
And say the positions that they hold.
Right. Okay. All except three executives are male. And the female positions are the Commission for Women. The Women's Organization. Those are the only two that are women. In terms of the chief executives of the divisions and commissions, all except two are male. All except three are white males. There is a black man who is the head of the Commission for Multicultural Ministries. Okay. So just dealing here with in terms of women and men. On the voluntary side, and when I say voluntary, I'm just really referring here to people who aren't paid. The vice president of our church is a woman, Christine Grum. That's a voluntary, non-paid position. Many of the board chair people are women. If you follow the elections that have come now since the first board meetings in Chicago. Several of those committees, as I understand it, really sat down and said, who do we want as the chair of our board? What will be important for us to say? Some of them made a deliberate decision that it really should be a person of color to head up the board. Some of them said, we really need to have a woman as a head of this board. So if you look at that list, I don't know the numbers, but there are many of the boards of the Global Mission and professional leadership groups, congregational life, those kinds of boards and commissions, you'll see many women's names. Now those are what I would characterize as voluntary positions. They're non-paid, they're part-time. They do have some kinds of power. I mean, there's some kind of power in both of these columns, and whether or not one is private and the other public, I don't know that those categories would really fit, but in a sense they do, because these would be the kinds of positions that somebody like a woman could take on and stay in her home. So I think there's some of that thinking from the 19th century that's still very much a part of us. It's okay for someone to chair the board of, say, church and society, but it's probably not okay for that same woman to head up that board, because that would be a full-time job and would take her out of the home. Now, that's a little too simplistic. I think a whole lot of things were going on this time around, which have ended up with this kind of split. There are no women who were elected as bishops. There were a few synods that had some women as finalists for that position. As somebody, you know, laughingly said here, there, in a sense, if it hadn't been structured in that there would be a commission for women and a continuation of the women's organization, all of these executives would be male. Now, some have argued that if the structure hadn't included a commission for women and a commission for multicultural ministries, that then the church would have really bent over backwards to put women into those positions. I fail to believe that argument. I think, indeed, what would have happened is that we would have had all executive positions being filled by men, and that there wouldn't have been any women in the cabinet of executives. Because of the structure the way it is, we do end up at least with these two women on the cabinet of executives and one black man. There also, if you look at the assistants to the bishop, there are some places where there are women. The woman, there's a woman who is the head of the Office for Research, Planning and Evaluation, and one of Bishop Chilstrom's three executive assistants is a woman, Lita Johnson, who is AELC and comes from the Office of Governmental Affairs in Washington. But let me simply read something to you, and you take this with a grain of salt, because this person does not speak for anyone but himself, and I think it's important to understand that. Some of you may read Forum Letter, which is written really by Richard Newhouse, who is a commentator on many things, but of churchly things and Lutheran things in particular. And this is from an issue, actually, which I have done in response to him, which is called Opinion instead of Forum. And if some of you have an interest in reading that, you can ask me about getting a copy. This is what he says in his July issue of Forum as a kind of analysis of the position of women in the convention, the last convention. Just say no, urges Newhouse, to the intimidating sexism of the various women's caucuses. It's as simple as that, he says. Say no to women as bishop in the church. After all, any woman seeking this office, now this is my interpretation of what he says, I'll tell you when I quote him directly. After all, any woman seeking this office must be doing so out of self-serving ambition alone. And then I do quote here. With respect to blacks, inclusivity means mission. With respect to women, it refers to the ambition of a minority, of a majority already in the church, namely women. He goes on to make a connection between the situation, between women and blacks, suggesting, I think, that indeed the reason that there wasn't more support at the National Convention for black candidates was because the Women's Caucus had already zeroed in to support one candidate, namely, in that case, myself. He goes to great lengths in the July issue to talk about why it was so surprising that my name should have been among the last four candidates, and to say that none of the women who has ever been suggested for the office of bishop has the kind of qualifications that are needed for that office. In fact, this is what he said. Most of the women suggested for the office of bishop have had very limited experience and are in minor or even marginal positions of ministry. If granted that this is one man speaking for himself, Richard Neuhaus reaches many who wish they would have been able to say the same things or who were thinking the same things. And what I sense now in our church is, I think, a kind of backlash. And I may be wrong, but I would be very happy to get some feedback from the men and women here today, that we may be really afraid that women have gotten too much out of the private sphere into the public. And in a sense, we're trying to say no. Just say no. And he picks this up from a drug campaign. So it's even, I mean, he admits that himself. So, I mean, I think he does that purposely. One of my male colleagues, a clergyman from Pennsylvania, reporting recently on the convention, told a group of pastors and lay people in one of the Pennsylvania synods that my presence at the constituting convention as a candidate for bishop was one of the most dangerous things that he had seen in the church in his experience. Now, I don't know exactly what that meant, but I think we do have to hear a word like dangerous is a very particular kind of word. It's not surprising. It's not the same as saying it was surprising that there was a woman candidate. It's a word that comes from some place, I think, that man himself couldn't even explain. To say that it is a dangerous thing to, and I don't know whether it was me in particular or that a woman was considered through so many ballots for that office of the church, if that in its sense in itself was what was dangerous. I'm not sure, as having not talked to him. And he didn't call me to speak about it. But I think as I hear back, as I begin to hear things from across the country, I'm aware that what Richard Neuhaus says, even though it's his own personal opinion, does reverberate around the church, and that there are people in my synod, Metro New York, it would primarily be my male colleagues in the clergy for whom I think a word like dangerous is very accurate, that there is something about it to them that is very scary, very frightening, and whether or not it's that they fear losing their own positions or if it's just such a big change for them in the way things have been laid out that you get, we're beginning, I think we'll begin to see now a kind of backlash that hasn't occurred before. It, because of things like the word inclusiveness, you in certain gatherings that word now brings either a kind of uneasy laughter or you know, just kind of disgust. And yet we see what has happened in our church even with some guidelines for inclusiveness, that we have ended up, I think, really where we are, with a lot of the power in terms of the public sphere still being pretty much exclusively in the hands of men. And the voluntary, part-time, now under here, of course, would be all of the women who are part of the church, which is by far the largest percentage of our membership. Voluntary giving, voluntary service, the kind of volunteer work that has been done in terms of women's organizations over the years, and the paid positions, the control decisions as far as most of the budget making decisions of the church would continue to be in this sphere. And I think we could ask a question, and maybe I will throw that out as to get some feedback there, of whether or not you have a sense that women do belong in this institution that we call the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. Or does this really say, some black people, frankly, have just said, forget it. I have had it. You know, I've had it with this white church. And I have some friends in the East, and it's not limited to the East, but who just said, you know, before we at least had two bishops. And now in the new church, we have none. And you're telling me that this is an inclusive church. So there's a lot of, there's a real kind of despair and anger, I think, among people of color who are Lutherans. Where women are and where men are, I'm not sure exactly, but I'll be happy to hear where. And you can, I'll throw it open, and you can respond to either things I've said or some of the things that Val had said or some of the things you say to each other. Yeah.
Could it be a fear of relinquishing power on the part of males? They're more opposed to feminism as such, and maybe feminism is kind of part of the thing they're opposing. Threatening the threat of feminism, not women as such, but they consider maybe feminism is a power.
And when you say feminism, there, what do you think they think feminism is?
Women pushing too hard, probably.
I think there is a fear of relinquishing power.
Yes.
Some would argue that what feminism really would call for is a sharing of power, and whether, of course, I think there's a very the Magnificat is a kind of biblical calling. There is that you don't get any power. I mean, unless somebody also gives up some power. So I mean,
I'm not saying women shouldn't. I'm not, this isn't my personal opinion.
No,
I'm just saying the word itself is not a good word.
Feminism.
Mm-hmm.
I think it has been a very misunderstood kind of word, because I think what it, if there is a kind of classical definition of feminism, I think it simply is calling for another look at the world, and that it isn't, that it has been described up to this point in time in a very biased way, in kind of patriarchal terms. And so, you know, nobody ever talks about patriarchal theology in a seminary, which is what most of it is, you see. Most of what all of us have been taught who have been in seminary have studied patriarchal theology. And sometimes we have had a little bit of feminist theology or liberation theology, but nobody ever talks about patriarchal theology.
No.
Some women now are starting to talk about male stream theology as another kind of category. So it doesn't look like there simply is pure theology, and then there are these kind of adjuncts over here like feminist theology and black theology. And so feminism is another kind of way of looking at the world, just like patriarchy has been a way of looking at and describing the world. And I think that what the word usually means is that it's women trying to take over. I mean, I think so.
That's what I mean.
If I were a man and I had described the world in a certain way, and I had said that it had a private public split, and that the women were to stay at home and be in a private place, you see what Val was talking about then is then what how do you explain what happened then, that these women began to pray and began to, and that men began to come to their prayer meetings and came to be converted, and then men came to affirm that if you're talking about the holiness of a person, you couldn't make those kinds of distinctions. Which eventually, I think, the Lutheran denomination led to the ordination of women in the Lutheran Church. But one thing that's been said among many women in other denominations is that what especially happened with the Episcopal women who were ordained irregularly, the first 11, one of them said to me recently, what our liberal male colleagues thought would happen is that we would become ordained and then we would just learn to fit in. But it isn't simply the presence of women. It is that women want to describe things in a different way and bring in a different definition. So now there is a backlash against some of those women who have been ordained because they are asking questions about how a meeting is run, where the budgets, where budgets are spent, how we make decisions. That was a big problem in the commission on the new church. It was a kind of uproar at times because people didn't just follow everything the way that it had been done before. Robert's Rules of Orders didn't always fit. And people were raising questions that nobody wanted to answer. And so things didn't go so smoothly. So when you bring in people who have a different definition of what the world even looks like, and I think any of us who have, you know, talked with people from other cultures or who have really seriously listened to Native Americans, you know that the way I describe the world simply isn't the objectively the way it is. And that, I think, is very frightening, because women are describing things in a different way. Yeah.
I'm wondering if the there is a kind of a long, like they talk about how long it takes for the water in Lake Superior to turn over, the turnover time, you know, in terms of these ideas, different ways of looking at things, different theologies, and different ways of exploring, you know, the Christian faith. And also different ways of looking at the leadership of the church aren't just really lagging and slowly turning over. You know, it's I'm from Fargo, North Dakota, and a pastor there. Mm-hmm. And I'm just now, even in this workshop, figuring out that you were the one that was on the ballot. Yeah. So isn't that an honor to say, well, I didn't remember. But there was a lot of people who thought that was pretty nice. That it even went that far.
Oh, right.
You know, I mean, there was a, to me, there was a sort of a positive feeling among our congregation, at least. That, boy, well, this sure is a slow, lazy-bones church, but at least there's some little progress. There's some little show of whatever there, you know.
All the women in the United States are proud.
Well, I think it was a very, I think it was an important time. And somebody told me that if you look at a surf coming in, the waves coming in, there, that a wave before it really moves ahead, and although I've been at the ocean many times, I can't really attest to this being true, but there's a kind of backward movement first before the wave really moves on. And somebody has said to me recently that in terms of the results of the real elections and things is that maybe that we just, it's a sign that we're moving backwards, but ultimately we'll make some forward movement. I don't know. I think somebody else.
Sorry to interrupt you.
No, please.
There's so many other influences happening right now. What if this ELCA hadn't been happening during the Reagan years?
Yeah.
Which is a backlash. And what if this had been also, but there were there are just so many things in the climate right now that, you know, it is very sad to me to say these are blacks, and because I'm in a position right now where I'm working just outside the church in some of the ways that those women that you described are, I feel a sadness for my church. And I feel like I'm just on the fringe of my institution. And I, you know, there's sometimes that is up for grabs. But then what about my community? So I echo what you were asking about. Yeah. Although I don't like saying it anymore.
When Martin Luther King Jr. was in jail in Birmingham, you know, and a group of white clergy wrote him a letter and said, quit what you're doing in Birmingham, you're ruining the city, be patient, wait. You know, he wrote back a famous letter, and one of the things he said was, when you tell us to wait, and we've been waiting for centuries, what you're saying to us is never. Wait means never, the way you use it. So, you know, I guess we won't know till later whether what we actually saw was a wait, meaning never, or whether we saw the backlash of the wave that was beginning to crash.
Yeah. A lot of things did get diluted in this time of constituting, too. I wasn't at Columbus, but I was at my own Synod's constituting convention, and it seemed like we were distracted by so many concerns. Mm-hmm. There were lay clergy concerns that were very present. There were, bringing in the people of color and primary language other than English was the term we decided to use at our convention. There were certainly the ALC-LCA power plays and breakdowns. I mean, in some areas of the country more than others. It was very much in the Pacific Northwest. So many of those things kind of there's all these tangents of things going on that distracted. One of the things that I noticed was that in our bishop's election, there seemed to be a lot of the ALC-LCA breakdown. But then when we got to electing our Synod Council, then all of a sudden, people got very conscientious about people of color, and also all suddenly realized that there were no women clergy even on the ballot. And that was taken care of. We ended up with two women clergy and I think five or six people of color, language other than, and it was suddenly this rallying of, oh yeah, we better pay attention to this, kind of thing. So that gives me some hope that that maybe when we're not so distracted by some of these other things that
it may be the never that Val's talking about, and mean that we're willing to have women and people of color in the voluntary slots, and that the move to where we perceive the real power to be will never be made. Now, another question that I think we could go on for a long time is, where does the real power reside in the church? I mean, is it in the office of the bishop, or is it in the pews where the people sit, or is it in the boards? Or, I mean, that would be another whole kind of discussion to have. And I would not want us to give up simply because we don't have any bishops who are women, because I think I have personally come to a point where I'm not sure that one woman elected as bishop could survive very well. And we have to come up with some ways of supporting women who do get elected or appointed to positions, because someone who works for the National Presbyterian Church told me not long ago the one thing that they've seen is, once isolated, soon fired, or soon crushed, or soon destroyed, or soon co-opted. And I think that I, sitting here now, can think of few things more difficult than being the only woman at a conference of bishops meeting. So I think we have to think about, are there other places from which women can speak, and maybe even speak better and more faithfully than being the one woman bishop? But somebody there had a hand up in the red a while ago.
How long has the Lutheran Church been ordaining women?
Since
1970.
So 17 years.
How many are there?
It's about 5% of the total now. And I'm not sure whether it's maybe 800 or 600 or...
And how long
but
does a
seminary now?
Does a minister, does it take to become a bishop? I mean, how long have these bishops been practicing?
Some of them are still practicing.
As a woman, and whatever it does, you're going to be twice as long unless you're put up as a figurehead, unless they'd like to make you special. But
I think there are a number of women who are qualified to be a bishop. The notion of paying dues, I think, is a male kind of term, but it also varies greatly. Our bishop in Metro New York is a very well-known person who has done all kinds of things in terms of the worldwide church, the national church, and it has been a professor, Bill Lazarus. I mean, his name is well known as any of the bishops elected. He has served 4 years in a parish, and that just recently. Now, some people would say, well, how can that be? How can somebody who's only served 4 years in a parish? Well, nobody would raise the question in terms of Bill Lazarus. Mm-hmm. Now, Newhouse would claim that it would be ludicrous for me to be elected when I've only served 6 years in the parish. Now, it depends on who's asking the question, you know, but I think there are a number of women, just to answer that, who have, because of prior experience, but also in terms of the 17 years that women have been ordained. Some women were ready to be ordained right when that happened. So they have, we have women who have been assistants to bishops, who have been parish pastors, who have taught in seminaries. Not hundreds, but you have to look at the long list of 65 men elected and say, are there any women that have similar qualifications, not to Bill Lazarus or Herb Chilstrom, but look at the list. You know, not everybody elected has taught seminary and been here and there and everywhere for a long time, yeah.
I'm a clergywoman in the United Methodist Church. And there are about four of us now in the Pacific Northwest, and we have a number of bishops. And a question that came to my mind is, do you as clergywomen in the Lutheran Church organize? I know I'm going to a conference in August that they had to put a lid on and limit it to 1,000 United Methodist clergy women nationally. But it's a very powerful kind of time of networking and supporting one another so that we are not isolated and marginalized. And I'm wondering if you do that.
We have no national support for doing that. It's done regionally, I'd say, in terms of women getting together within a synod. We had an anniversary event in 1985 when there was the 15th anniversary of the ordination of women. And it was in the Northeast, but there were women from other parts of the country who came to it. There is a perception among many people that there is a very powerful women's caucus in the church. It simply isn't true. There's not an organization of women clergy that I know of. It happens in pieces. In some places, there are groups that are very supportive. But you know, you see, the United Methodist brings up an interesting kind of polity that I have often said that the only way that we could have women bishops in a responsible way would be to elect them in a different way, which of course is anathema, I think, to most Lutherans. But I mean, the United Methodist, which is a perfectly legitimate Christian denomination in this country, elects bishops and throughout the world. But I'm just talking now about the Lutherans in this country. I mean, in the way we elect bishops, assuming it's the only way. But the way that you elect, as I understand, is at a larger jurisdiction, and then the bishops are assigned to an area, usually not the area from which they have come. And so there is much better chance that you will have more than one woman elected. I mean, you could imagine if in the Midwest region, the region elected 10 bishops, there might be the notion that, well, you know, one could be a woman, or two, you know, and then if you elected in that way, it would be much more possible that across the country you would have as many as five or six women elected. But, I think if we had a different polity, we would have a change, but that may not, yeah.
It strikes me that part of your backlash isn't so much as somebody pushing against the bandwagon, but I think a lot of people fell off. You know, I remember, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, it was a big thing that we want, you know, women should be ordained. And I remember that, you know, I think I was in high school or undergraduate, and I think when that was attained, it's easy to say, fine, women can do, now we have equality in the church, we can do whatever we want. Yeah, and then you go off and do other things and get involved with your family or your career. And I think this may be a good reminder that that's not true, and perhaps it's very helpful that there isn't one
woman bishop, because we could then say the same thing. Well, see, we have a woman bishop. We're doing just great, and go back to our own little, you know, little sphere. So I think it's easy to get apathetic if we look back and say, gosh, look how far we've come. And it's really interesting to hear.
I think the other, just to follow up on that, and then I'll get over here. I think the other people who have fallen away are some women who have been very strong women who simply have given up. Mm-hmm. And that's, I mean, we can, and I'll name names. I mean, where is Elizabeth Bettenhausen, who is not now on the church council? She for years was a member of the church council, is a brilliant ethicist, one of the finest scholars and theologians we have in the Lutheran Church, and was on the commission. And I think you could name a number of women and say, where are they? They're no longer on any official boards. They maybe have gone to non-institutional places. She teaches in a non-Lutheran seminary. And who do we hire in our seminaries? Who is safe enough? Where are the really radical voices? Where is Mary Pellauer, who does some of the finest writing on violence against women? I'm sure could never get a job in a Lutheran seminary. Has never been elected to a board. I think the other people who have fallen away, some of us have become apathetic, but some have also just said, there isn't a place for me here. Nobody wants to listen to what I have to say. And that's where my greatest sadness is, that we've also lost men who wanted to say something different, you know, and how much do we dare to listen to is a real important question for Lutherans in this country, because we can become real, real rigid, I think, more than some other denominations. Yeah.
I think this is pertinent. I just wanted to ask about the quota system of voters. That was supposed to cure some of this. And what, the number of women voters approached 50% when electing bishops, and yet there was no groundswell among women to elect women. What construction do you put on that?
Well, somebody from some of the other synods have been talking to me about that, too. I think that one of the things that happened, evidently, in specific cases, is that women had very high expectations of the women, higher than they had of the men that they were also voting for, you know. So they would say, well, I had bad experience with Susie Jones, you know, in a meeting once. And so it was almost as though everything... And this is a problem, I think, when people are thinking about who is going to be the first of anything elected, the first of anybody. I mean, if it's going to be the first woman, then it's going to have to be somebody so perfect, almost, that it's unreasonable, you know. And I think women began to ask those kinds of questions. I mean, well, you know, no, she really hasn't had the experience, or no, she's too quiet, or she's too abrasive, or she's too intellectual, she's not intellectual enough, where we have allowed ourselves to vote for some men for whom we would, you know, those same qualifications we worried about. But we worry about them more with a woman, because I think in reality we know that the woman is going to be subjected to a different kind of judgment. I mean, people are going to look at her and say, well,
we still haven't experienced
it. It just didn't work.
But isn't that an issue of church politics then? You have to convince your electorate. I'm not saying you should have done that or whatever, but then it becomes real political, I guess.
Well, I think in reality it probably needs to be more openly political than it has been. I think it is political, very political, but I think that... I have questions about the ecclesiastical ballot as a reasonable way to elect a bishop, and I think that we may see some shifting around on that. I think it's very difficult to come into a convention with lay and clergy delegates and sit down and write down a name and then assume that it is the work of the Holy Spirit. I think all of us have felt at times that really has been the case, but more than anything it has been you know, somebody who is well known, who doesn't need to campaign in a sense, and then if anybody looks like they're campaigning, like the charge was made against Ken Senft at the national convention, all kinds of phone calls had been made around the country and on behalf of Martin Marty before he dropped out. And then a lot of those same phone calls on behalf of Bill Lazarus. Well, nobody ever said, gosh, those men were really campaigning. But the minute some others, you know, made it known that they were supportive of Ken Senft, then he was campaigning, whereas all of the others had sort of fallen from heaven. I mean, I think that the whole system is problematic. But I can't say, except that women are in many, many different places too. I mean, I think that all the women, where we began was just the issue of feminism. There are some women for whom that word itself is very frightening. There are women in seminaries right now who don't want to meet with other women in caucuses or in small groups because they're afraid that they will be labeled either as lesbians or labeled as, you know, anti-men, or that they simply won't get a job, or that they don't think there's a problem. So there are all kinds of places that women are at too. So that's, I don't have much more of an explanation for that, except I think women need to learn to do that better, to really get behind somebody and be supportive.
The,